the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Last Tuesday, the House Natural Resources Committee held a legislative hearing on Representative John Curtis's House Resolution Number 4532, titled The Shasta National Monument and Indian Creek National Monument Act.
The bill would not only codify President Trump's dismantling of Bears Ears National Monument, but also delegate management of the monument to local officials and tribal representatives handpicked by the Trump administration, foregoing input from tribal governments. The bill would also exclude three of the five tribes that advocated for the protection of Bears Ears.
Joining us in the first part of the show to discuss the specifics of this resolution, which may actually become a bill, and its impacts on not just Bears Ears, but Grand Staircase Escalante as well, will be Dave Pacheco. He's grassroots organizer for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance.
Then in the second part of the show, we'll speak with Dr. James Staggy of the USU Water Research Lab. Jim and his collaborators are looking into the past to better understand an increasingly uncertain water future. By analyzing centuries-old growth rings from trees in the Intermountain West, the researchers are extracting data about monthly streamflow trends from periods long before the early 1900s when recorded observations began. These can then be used by our water managers and the general population to better understand what we may face in the future.
That's in the second half of the show.
That is.
All right. Now, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our email address, thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJuria Center at High Star Ranch, and ESCO Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's ESCO, E-S-C-O.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
Well, the area of Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante now contain five smaller national monuments. In fact, Bears Ears is just the ears. That's it.
That's it.
So they've reduced it just
the two ears.
There's not even a bear. It's just two ears. I joke, but believe me, it's been reduced in size almost to that point. Last week, the House Committee of Natural Resources held a hearing for House Resolution 4532 involving two of those monuments in the Bears Ears area. That's what Bears Ears has been reduced to, two monuments. And they've renamed the monument from Bears Ears, if I understand it, to the Shasta, hopefully pronouncing that correctly, National Monument and Indian Creek National Monument. Joining us to talk about what this House resolution is about, the details, what it means, what it doesn't, is Dave Pacheco. He is the Utah grassroots organizer for the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Dave, thanks for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's start with, first of all, how do you pronounce this two new national monument? Is it Shasta?
Yes, that's correct. That's the Navajo word for the Bears Ears Buttes. And it gets to the point of what this is all about. The Utah politicians have hand-selected the language from one of the five tribes to call this small monument.
Right.
At the exclusion of the rest of the tribes. And on the front end, when Bears Ears was pushed by the five tribal governments, the Zuni, the Hopi, the Ute Mountain Ute, the Ute Tribal Nation, and the Navajo Nation, the agreement within the tribes themselves was that they would go with an English word for these buttes because it represented the whole, and they weren't hand-selecting one tribe interest over the others. And that's what this new bill does, is it says, well, if you're not here in Utah, you tribes, then you don't get a say.
Wow. Okay, so Shasta is a Navajo term?
Correct.
Okay. And the Navajo tribe actually supports this House resolution or the effort?
No, they're very against it.
All right, well, we're getting too far down. Let's start with, if you can, summarize what this House resolution, H.R. 4532, is all about.
Well, I think Nell summed it up in her introduction. The bill does two things. It codifies President Trump's illegal actions on December 4th, and it undermines tribal sovereignty. Those are the two main things that it does. Of course, that's contrary to what the Utah politicians are saying that it does. They're saying it establishes the nation's first tribally managed monument, and that is clearly false. It does not do that. And the reason it does not do that is by creation of a council that is supposed to provide input into the management of the new monument, this one smaller one. And it does so by appointing representatives who are not from the tribal nations. So first off, it's a 7-person council consisting of 2 San Juan County commissioners.
That's heavy representation from a local.
It's all about local control mm-hmm. here. So it would be 2 San Juan County commissioners who opposed Bears Ears in the first place. It would consist of 3 members of the Navajo Nation and 1 member of the White Mesa Ute Mountain Tribe as appointed by the Utah Congressional Delegation.
Oh.
So not selected by the tribes themselves. They're handpicked, cherry-picked individuals who happen to be Ute or Navajo who will go along with the delegation because, of course, just like any culture, not everyone is of one mind. So they'll handpick people who are on their side to represent the tribes who have completely different interests. These are sovereign nations. They went to President Obama as independent nations asking for their voice to be considered in the management of these monuments. And now that has been taken away with elimination of Bears Ears National Monument and replaced with these locally appointed Utah Congressional Delegation appointed commissions. That does not represent tribal interests. And what's really important here is that it excludes the Hopi, the Zuni, and the Ute tribe completely from the equation.
Why does it exclude them? Is it because they're not in Utah? Is that their rationale?
I think that's the rationale, yeah, because they're not in Utah, which, of course, is completely anathema to the concept of federal public lands.
Right.
What's not represented here is the nation's voice in how these lands are managed. Yesterday was Civil Rights Day, Martin Luther King holiday, and I was thinking about this on the drive up here. This bill is tantamount to saying that Alabama has the control and the ultimate decision on slavery back in the 1800s. It's like in today's society, turning over the decision to Alabama or Mississippi to determine whether or not they want to be a slave state again.
Right. Okay. So that's the rationale, though about excluding these other nations if they're not actually present. Have a physical
here
presence
anymore.
Yeah. That's a good point now because Sean Chapoose, who's an elected member of the Ute Tribal Business Committee, testified at this hearing, congressional hearing, and he was asked if the bill, this bill, would improve government-to-government consultation with the 5 tribal nations in the Bears Ears area, and he said, quote unquote, "No, it won't. All this is going to do is divide us, I guess, the tribal nations further." And what's pretty interesting in this, we know there's a challenge in court. Put to push us through basically shuts the door on the legal process. So this isn't going to help anybody. If anything, I guess we're going to draw our lines, the nation's lines, and we are going to start pushing harder and harder against each other or against it. So it fractionates these
nations.
Yeah,
well, there's 2 points here. One is that this coming together of these 5 tribes behind Bears Ears was a historic moment.
Yeah.
These tribes have always been in these areas and oftentimes were at odds with each other, fighting over the same territory. This Bears Ears proposal represented the opportunity for long-time wounds to be healed between tribal nations. This move by Representative Curtis and by Donald Trump have started to shatter those bonds that have been started to heal. And then I forget my other point.
Well, that happens. It's live radio. Right. Yeah, right. So just to follow up on a few of these points. So when President Trump made his initial announcement or proclamation about changing, you know, decreasing the size of Bears Ears and Grand Staircase, was that effective immediately, or is this bill required to pass, or this resolution required to pass in order to make that change? I guess what I'm asking is, do we still, some people are still referring to the entire designated national monument area as Bears Ears National Monument, and some are kind of seeing it as a former national monument. Where does it actually stand?
Yeah, this was the point that I spaced a second ago. But essentially what happened was that when the president announced that he was going to, this is through executive order, was going to eliminate the proclamations that President Obama made and President Clinton made for these two monuments and replace them with five new smaller monuments, that act in and of itself was, in our minds and in the tribe's minds, illegal. So we sued. The thing that didn't happen in the lawsuit was a temporary injunction or a preliminary injunction, a restraining order, if you will, to stop that Trump's order from going into effect. So in essence, right now, Bears Ears National Monument and Grand Staircase Ascalon National Monument, as we knew them, do not exist. They have been replaced by five other monuments. But because the wheels of justice turn slowly, that's going to take a while to figure out. We think that the first hearing may be heard within 9 months. Wow. So it's going to take a little while. And meanwhile, the Utah politicians, you know, much to their credit, understand this, right? They know that this was probably an illegal act. So they're trying to legislate exactly what Trump did in through his executive orders to make it the law. In essence, what they're trying to do is stop the lawsuits from taking effect later or from being heard later on. If they can, in the next 9 months, get legislation passed through the U.S. Congress, that's the new law in this country. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. They make law. And therefore, it renders unnecessary what Trump did. And in fact, the legislation for both Bears Ears and Grand Staircase, these two bills, one by Curtis, one by Stewart, what they do is nullify not only the Clinton and Obama proclamations, but they also nullify Trump's proclamations. So it wipes out any potential for there to be any court case because there would be no basis for it anymore. So essentially, they're trying to get their way two different directions here.
Well, let me just say what the governor, who also was at this committee hearing, said. In effect, he says, quote, "These are lands owned not by Utahns only and not by the Navajos only or other tribes. These are owned by all Americans. Therefore, you, the Congress, are responsible for how we, in fact, manage those lands through the Interior Department and through the BLM. So the challenge for this body, Congress, is to find a legislative solution, getting input from all stakeholders, and then coming up with a legislation bill that will solve this issue." He speaks exactly what you're saying. This is about Congress formulating and signing off on a bill. And of course he's going to say that because it's a Republican majority Congress.
Yeah, it's not surprising that he said that, but it's very interesting that he said that in light of the fact that over the previous 3 or 4 years, in fact, on this very program, I was up here talking quite extensively about Congressman Bishop's Public Lands Initiative, where the Utah politicians had the opportunity to pass legislation that, you know, met the needs of all interests here. That was their job, and they failed miserably. That bill went nowhere, and it's because exactly the same thing was happening then as is now, which is the Utah politicians believe that all public land decision making should be done at the local level only, and that the United States of America, with its strong standards in terms of environment, protecting for endangered species, protecting for other cultural resources and stuff, that those laws supersede the wants and desires of local interests, and therefore they won't have it. And it's because of that intransigence against having any federal control here at all that they failed. And that's why we're in this situation that we're in today. It was only because of that President Obama stepped in and made Bears Ears National Monument.
Now, is there any precedent for, you know, HB 4532 or HR 4532? Has anything like this, you know, been passed before changing a national monument?
Historically speaking, there may have been a few times when national monuments were reversed. Back in the war years, back in World War I, there was Olympic National Park that was downsized from an initial monument, but then was later restored and increased in size to a national park after the wars were over. But there has been no legislation passed since 1976, when the overarching law that gives BLM its teeth, the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, was passed, which essentially said that that these downsizings of monuments by presidents, this is Congress's job, essentially. So in some respects, yes, it is Congress's job to tackle these issues. I mean, they are perfectly within their right to debate these in the Congress. We're just saying that it shouldn't be passed.
Yeah. Now, does the same hold for Grand Staircase Escalante? Will another House resolution be brought up to address Grand Staircase Escalante in the same way?
It already has, Chris. It was heard in the U.S. House of Representatives, House Natural Resources Committee, the very committee where the bill we're talking about here was just heard last week. This was held on December 12th. So before the Christmas break, Congressman Chris Stewart, ran his bill that does essentially the same thing. It codifies President Trump's move on Grand Staircase, breaking it in half into three smaller pieces. In that bill, though, there's a really interesting twist where Congressman Stewart is in one of those three areas proposing a new national park be designated in one of those three areas, the Escalante Canyons area. Suffice it to say that that would be a park in name only. It would again do the same sort of thing that we've been talking about, take the management plan and put it into the hands of local officials and out of the hands of the American public. It changes the concept of a national park as we know it by making it a national park that focuses on public lands grazing of cattle, of hunting, and for motorized vehicle use. So it does exactly the same thing. We're really talking about two bills that are, you know, kind of companion bills here.
All right. So, and again, the GSE is being reduced dramatically in size.
In half,
down to these, three small parcels?
Correct.
Okay. So that's moving forward, too. Obviously, you said, I believe you said in prior to the show, that this is probably going to be voted out of committee, approved out of the House Natural Resources Committee, and then it goes to the floor of the House of Representatives for a full vote.
Yeah, so the process is that there's a hearing, and that's been done, where the bill is discussed. And next step in the process is a markup, which means that there's a committee vote. Mm-hmm. Congressman Bishop said last week that he would probably mark up both of these bills, one for Grand Staircase, one for the former Bears Ears, by around February 14th. I think he said by that date. So it should be done either on that date or before. So what that means is the bills then go to the main House floor, where Congressman Bishop has to essentially fight for time against all of America's other needs to determine whether or not the bill actually gets heard and voted on in the House floor. And then, of course, the whole process starts over in the Senate. The thing that they've got running against them right now is time. They're in the second year of a two-year Congress, and the clock is ticking. This is an election year. Primarily an election year. They kind of stopped doing work around August for all intents and purposes. But, of course, they do frequently come back when they can't get anything done, which has been the trend in the last several years. Sometime in October, right before the election, they can still do business. So they've got about a year to get the bill passed. We're strongly encouraging folks to oppose this bill. And on good grounds, on grounds that it codifies what President Trump did, and that it, in Berger's case, removes tribal sovereignty. The main overriding problem with both of these bills is that it takes the management authority out of America's public hands and puts it into local control, and that's really where the problems rise. once you have the locals making decisions on this, when the American public doesn't get an opinion, you start to have problems like allowing for more motorized vehicle routes. You allow for, you know, and that causes all
resource
kinds of problems.
Extraction,
you know,
resource logging.
Extraction, you know, it comes with all sorts of environmental problems at that point, let alone the tribal argument here.
Does it set a precedent for other national monuments efforts on, because Zinke is looking at, I think it was 26 national monuments in total, reviewing them. And so this could set a precedent for the reduction or otherwise reboundering of other national monuments.
It certainly could.
Okay. So the precedent is there if this goes through. Now, it has to go through the Senate, and the Senate is a different chamber, a different body, a little more deliberative in its methods, but I'm sure Senators Lee and Hatch will probably escort a bill or fashion a bill. They'll probably be the ones that try to, you know, champion the bill in the Senate. Is that the thought there?
Yeah, that's expected.
That's expected? Okay. All right. So, Dave, a couple more minutes. Where do people go to learn more about what Sue is doing about this effort and read about H.R. 4532?
You can certainly go to our website. It's suwa.org, S-U-W-A.org. You can also find information from the tribes themselves at protectbearsears.org and utahdenebakea.org. Those are the two of the tribal organizations working towards this. I want to mention really quickly before we go that it's not just the votes that are coming up that are important on this, but an important period kicked off last Friday for Grand Staircase and will probably kick off today for Bears Ears, and that is the management planning process. So this is the agency process, so the Department of Interior moving forth with attempting to get to codify Trump's plans into action. So they've kicked off a 60-day comment period, ostensibly for the American public to have their voice in this matter. So this could be the only chance we have to influence the management plan. We know how that went last time when over 2 million people across the country stated in favor for Bears Ears National Monument to stay as it was, and that was under Zinke's review, and that was woefully ignored. So,
yeah.
You know, we do still encourage people to get involved. We need to be on the record, establishing that record that people want to see Bears Ears the way it was and Grand Staircase the way that it was. So please participate in the planning process. That information will be on the SUA website. If not already, then it'll be there very soon in the next couple of days.
And I'll go back to the governor's words. These are lands owned not by Utahns only and not by the Navajos only or other Native tribes. These are owned by all Americans. And all Americans made their voice known in submitting over 1 million comments to the Department of Interior. And I think it was, 9-1? 9.5-1 in terms
9.9-1, depending on who you, yeah.
In terms of being in favor of protecting and keeping Bears Ears as it was. But like you say, you know, it's their land management on their terms, right? And that's what they're doing. But our voices can still be heard on this. So Dave Pacheco, grassroots organizer with Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, thanks so much for taking the time to come on and talk to us about this issue, and we'll follow it and stay in touch.
Thanks for having us on, Chris.
All right.
Thanks, Dave.
Let's take a break for some underwriters, and we come back. We're going to turn our attention to watersheds.
That's right. We can't get away
from
watersheds.
As I say in New Jersey, water. Yeah. Watersheds.
Water. we'll be speaking with Dr. James Staggy of the USU Water Research Lab about using tree rings to look at our hydrologic past here in Utah.
Is that possible?
It turns out that it is.
That's right. It's this green earth. We'll be right back.
This is Brenda with Republic Services, your local provider for recycling and garbage collection. Information about what is acceptable to put in your curbside recycling bin can be found at summitcountyrecycles.org. Please help Summit County be clean. Remember to recycle.
Hello, this is Diane Reinhart with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and have been providing our clients with real estate services since 1976. All current and active listings can be found on our website at bhhsutah.com, and our agents can help navigate the real estate market.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues, concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson. And now in the second half of the show, we'll be speaking with Dr. James Staggy of the USU Water Research Lab. He and his collaborators are looking into the past to better understand our uncertain water future. By analyzing centuries-old growth rings from trees in the Intermountain West, researchers are extracting data about monthly streamflow trends from periods long before the early 1900s when our recorded observations began. So these then can be used by water managers, individuals, the agricultural community, whoever, to better kind of understand what we may face in the future as the climate is changing,
right,
as snowpack is changing and things along
and
those lines.
And this is using tree rings from different types of trees.
Yeah, different species, different regions of trees, and it's down to a monthly basis here in three watersheds here in Utah, including the Weber River watershed, which is where we're located. And so we're just working, obviously, on getting Dr. Staggy on the phone right now.
Yeah, so.
And he can speak to this better, but there's incredible data and a really fun interactive website.
I will be curious to know how we do this, how he's be able to tease this information out on a monthly basis.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
Seasonal, looking at different seasons going back, not just decades, but hundreds of years before there was full formal quantification, instrumentation, let's say.
Yeah.
Using the trees as the instrument. All right, so we're still waiting to get a hold of Dr. Staggy. So let's take another break. And when we'll come back and hopefully we'll be online and on air. And we'll
That's
be
right.
To
and I won't
have
to talk too much about this for
or
him.
Or we'll move to another news item. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Margaret Schneider of Schneider Auto Carrossery Body and Paint, KPCW's newest supporter. Located at 1180 South and 400 West in Salt Lake City, we repair most cars and light trucks, whether it be a minor dent or a major collision. Detail services and more info at schneiderauto.net.
Welcome back
to This Green Earth, and we successfully have Dr. James Staggy on the phone joining us. Thanks so much for being here this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So we just did a brief introduction of you in your absence about the work that you're doing right now and your recent paper. Let's start with kind of the basics on this. This all starts with tree rings, right?
Yeah, and I guess I'll start with just really quickly about kind of the whole purpose of this. So I'm, you know, an engineer interested in looking at drought risk. And we want to kind of see how modern water systems here in Utah would perform, you know, during droughts and plan for the worst. And unfortunately, you know, here in Utah, we have a pretty small set of historical droughts to use for this. So, you know, the longest stream gauges in the area are about 70 to 100 years old. But sort of the next best thing that we have here are tree rings. And so we can use those as kind of an alternative stream gauge, and I can explain how that works in a second, to get something more on the order of 600 or 700 years. And just by that, we expand kind of the number of droughts that we can test against by six or seven times, which is a huge, huge help.
It's amazing to think that, you know, we can have solid stream flow data from, you know, the year 1400. But yet that's exactly what you can see when you hop on the website, which we can talk about a little bit more, to look at this historic data. So how does that use of the tree rings work?
Yeah. So you can imagine, obviously, the inside of a tree, and you can picture all of the rings. And each year, the tree grows and, you know, and leaves a ring from that year's growth. If we pick the trees carefully, they can estimate how much water was available in that year. So you could imagine in a good year, the trees have plenty of water, and so they grow more, which means a wider tree ring. We can go into the tree without destroying the tree. We can take cores if it's living, or we can use old wood and measure the width of each one of those rings. And then we have, like I said, 70 to 100 years or so of flow data. If we match up, if we make a relationship between the size of that tree ring and the flow during the part of the record that we have data on, the last 100 years, and we set that relationship, then we assume that it holds over the distant past, and then our trees become kind of a de facto stream gauge, and we can keep that relationship and push back as far back as we have tree rings. In this case, like you said, back to the 1400s.
Wow. And what trees do you look at, and are there trees that are better than others in providing this data?
Yeah. So, again, we're lucky here in the West. We have both some of the oldest trees in the world, and also some trees that are really good reference points for reconstructing flow. So we use trees primarily coniferous trees, so things like Douglas fir, bristlecone pine. Those are some of the best gauges for this part of the world.
Right, because bristlecone pines live, well, I bet those are the ones that are giving you data from 300-400 years ago.
Yeah, well, and we actually have Douglas fir chronologies that go back that far. I should clarify. So in each one, when I'm talking about a chronology, it's not a single tree that goes back, say, 400, 500 years. In some cases, they are. But we're also mixing, using what's called cross-dating. So at a single site, we'll have 10, 20, 30 trees, and we line up all of these different trees and kind of match up where their tree rings overlap. And by using that overlapping, we can also take dead trees and see where they land in the chronology and push back even farther than where our living trees are.
So how do you find these sites where the trees maybe haven't been impacted heavily by, you know, I don't know, by humans in one way or another? Or
insects.
Yeah, invasives. other
yeah.
impacts, yeah.
Yeah. So that that I leave to my one of our fantastic collaborators, Justin DeRose, who's at the U.S. Forest Service. So I can only speak a little bit in terms of citing. He's a dendrologist, so he's very attuned to that. But you want to choose, like you kind of were guessing there, or not guessing, but assuming, you want an undisturbed site that has some relationship to a river. So you want it to be reasonably close or within a watershed to a river that you're interested in. And you want the trees to be water stressed. So you can imagine if the tree is right next to the river, whether it's wet or dry, it's always going to be happy because there's always going to be plenty of water. You want to balance that, and you want to get a tree that oftentimes is on a slope and is water stressed so that in a dry year, it has trouble growing. And in a wet year, it's happy and grows lots. Those make the best sites, and they make the best gauges for water availability.
So what have you found about the, you know, Utah's water history, and how does it compare to what we've seen over, you know, the past decade or two?
Yeah. So I should, I should go a little bit farther. So so my background is in water engineering, and so really the exciting part about this research is that, and we can talk about this later, is that we can actually go more detail, and we can generate monthly flows as opposed to, you know, trees grow at an annual scale. But we're actually exploring flows at a monthly scale. And that's really critical as a water engineer, because we make decisions with regard to water, you know, at a monthly scale. So water managers and things are having to make decisions, and it really affects how we manage our reservoirs and things like that. All of that is to say that now we're actually pushing these flows into our systems models for, in our case, the Bear River and the Weber River, and we're seeing how the system would be affected given some of these old drought events. And what we're seeing is that the Dust Bowl, the 1930s, always comes up as one of the most severe events. But it's not quite as unique as we might have thought. There are periods in the 1400s and 1600s where we saw equally or close to as severe droughts. And in some cases, and this is sometimes more important for reservoirs, it's not having one really severe year. It's having 5, 10 years of sometimes you're putting two large drought events back to back, and they're both 5 or 6 years, and the system just would never recover. So we're seeing, we're testing our systems in lots of different and unique ways, but also ways that we know historically have happened in this part of the world.
So how do we compare our current, say, last 10 or 15 years, compare with history?
Yeah. So the last 10 or so years, you know, we've tended to see, you know, 2 to 3 year events. And that our reservoirs in this part of Utah are generally built to withstand a pretty severe 2 year shortage. And so you've seen, I'm most familiar with the Weber at the moment.
Which is where we're located, so that's perfect.
Right. Which is fantastic. Yeah, we actually are. Our one reconstruction is pretty close to where your studios are, so up in the headwaters. And that's another thing I should say, is that you want these reconstructions up in the headwaters where the gauge data hasn't been affected by reservoirs and things like that. But to answer your original question, you know, the last few years have been dry, and we've had some droughts. 2 or 3 year events where I know the Weber Basin has put in some management actions, you know, in that second or third year of the drought. But we know that there is pretty common to have 5, 6 year events over the history. Things that look more like the Dust Bowl or look like the mid-70s that were also pretty dry. So the systems would be more stressed if we had a repeat of those events. And I should also say that the last 100 years or so have been relatively wet, looking at a sort of the century scale relative to some of the previous centuries. So we've been somewhat fortunate. So not to be doom and gloom, but but we should be preparing for large drought events.
So with all of this, you know, with this big picture in mind, have you seen interest yet from water managers in these watersheds here in Utah, you know, to work together and look at this data and talk about what it might mean?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So we are, I can say for the same reason that I'm excited about this, you know, extending the record by 6 or 7 times, the water managers are excited about it as well. And so we are working with the Weber Basin Water Conservancy District to run these flows through. They've got great reservoir models, and we are running these flows through there. We've given them to them, and they're testing how their system would be affected given, you know, current demands, current population, but forced with the 1460s drought. And so it gives them a whole new range of drought types to test against. You know, we tend to get into a rut testing the same 2 or 3 events, the early 2000s, the 1970s, maybe the Dust Bowl, if we're lucky. But there's so many more sort of dimensions that you can test and so many more drought types that they can test. And so we are working very closely with them. We're also working here in the Bear River to also test and see how the system would be affected given these droughts.
And obviously this testing, this modeling can work anywhere in the country. You can take it to Colorado, you can take it to California, you can take it, you know, and evaluate tree rings in any part of the country that has trees, obviously old enough but it travels. This methodology travels.
Yeah, definitely. And to speak to that, and this is again one of the things that I'm excited about is we do have a website. So I'd invite your listeners to go. It's www.paleoflow.org. PALEOFLOW.org.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to that site, all of our data is open and available, and you can see it. And you can see the coverage that we have, not just in Utah, but in Colorado, in parts of the West, in the Great Plains. Even there's a reconstruction on the Potomac River. You know, that goes by Washington, D.C. So, yeah, this method does travel. And the fun thing, if your users are looking for something to do, I mean, you can pick 1492
right.
or pick the Declaration of Independence and see what flows were like here in Utah during those years. So it's a fun way to spend some time.
I'll tell you what I want to do. I want to find a 400-year-old bristlecone pine or what other spruce or firs. I want to find that, and I want to touch it because I want to know what an object, a living being that's 400 years old. Where do I go or is that kind of something you prefer that the public not be overly aware of? Those are sensitive areas.
Yeah, so there's two answers to that. In some cases, certainly, the absolute oldest trees have been, they sort of obscure where exactly they are.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that I've been to Great Basin National Park, mm-hmm. which is fantastic. It's just on the border with Utah and Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And there are bristlecone pines there that are, I believe, over 1,000 mm-hmm. years old.
Oldest. They might be the oldest trees.
Yeah, and so I, I'm not sure about touching them.
Right.
but certainly you can walk among them. I've done that. There's a hike that takes you right through them, and it really is fantastic to imagine what was going on when these trees were young.
Well, if I'm going to be called the tree hugger, then I'll, that's the tree.
Literal.
That's the tree I want to hug.
Very literal.
And maybe get something out of it. Yeah. Well, I got one more question. We have a couple minutes.
Yeah.
I know you're teasing out information with respect to water, water years, hydrologic conditions. Is there any way of teasing out information with respect to temperature and climate change, looking at tree rings? That's a separate study, so, I guess.
Yeah, there's a few answers to that. The first is yes, certainly. In fact, most of the research with respect to tree rings has been focused on temperature reconstruction,
mm-hmm.
For exactly the reason that you're mentioning. In fact, the Michael Mann hockey stick, mm-hmm. those type of reconstructions and figures, some of them make use of this tree ring data. So certainly that is an area that's not my area, but I suggest people can dig into that and find more about it. The other question about climate change and with respect to water is that we are, in the case of Weber Basin and Bear River, we are sort of using, we kind of call it the past as future, where if we're looking at climate change scenarios 50 years or 100 years down the line, and we see that we're going to have an increase in, say, five-year drought events, we can mine this big database that we have of the past and say, okay, which one of these droughts from the past look like what we think the future will be under different climate change scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a value there.
Okay.
Well, in the last couple minutes here, I wanted to ask kind of what's next for this research and where do you see it being applied and where else can you take it?
Yeah. So the first thing is, what we're so excited about here is that we're finally able to reconstruct flows at a monthly scale. That's really the big deal with regard to this research. And we focused in northern Utah. Our next step as researchers is to see, can this method be applied outside of Utah? So to reconstruct and make these types of flows available for water managers in Colorado, in the Pacific Northwest, in California, places that really need this data, and make it more available to more people. On the more local track, the next things and the current things is that we're working with water managers here in Utah to test all of these scenarios and to try to do more robust planning. And that will be, over the next few years, we'll be trying to come up with better planning, better water management plans for these systems based on these historical droughts.
Fantastic. Well, we have to wrap up. Is there anything, is there some place where listeners can go to learn a little bit more about this and check out the numbers for themselves?
Yeah. So again, I'd invite them to go to our website. It's again paleoflow.org, and spend some time, get your hands dirty, play with some flows, pull up a site that's near you, and actually experience what these flows actually look like.
Well, thank you very much. That was Dr. Jim Staggy from the Utah State University's Water Research Lab. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Staggy. Let's take a break for last set of underwriters, and we come back. It's pretty much time to wrap up.
Another show has flown by.
All right. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974. FredMarshallPainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
If you have a family history of diabetes, macular degeneration, glaucoma, or developing cataracts, having an annual eye exam is critical. This is Dr. Colleen Chuback with the Moran Eye Center at University of Utah Health. Early diagnosis and treatment can greatly reduce or prevent harm to your vision before damage occurs. Schedule your eye exam at the Redstone Health Center at 658-9200. University of Utah Health is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Oh, okay. It's the Screen Earth. We got a few minutes.
So we had one upcoming event that we wanted to share quickly. Tomorrow, Wednesday, January 17th, there is a little celebration with Summit County, Rocky Mountain Power, and Uber for the installation of a new electric vehicle fast charging stations in Kimball Junction. And so the ribbon cutting will be tomorrow at 11 a.m. For anybody that's interested in going to check that out.
Fast charging stations?
Fast charging stations.
Two of them. That's
is
the number
two?
I got. That's
all right,
what I read.
Two.
There's two
Perfect.
Of them. I think this is an effort too that to make to set up fast charging stations around the state.
Mm-hmm.
They want to create an interconnect up and down the Mountain West, and this would be one of them. This is a larger effort going on, I believe. So that's the goal.
And it says additionally Good. Aimed at accelerating the use of electric vehicles among ride-hailing companies. So, you know, hence kind of Uber's involvement. But
right.
What a great solution for our local
All right, that's
transportation
tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Good. And, of course, we got Sundance coming up. We have no show next week.
That's right. All public affairs hours are on hold for next week due to Sundance, of course.
Some film festival.
That's right. Some film festivals in town, it turns out.
Not totally.
So there will be Sundance, sort of Sundance special interviews all week.
There's
you can
a
learn
Sundance,
all about the films.
There's a Sundance
hear from the
reel.
Filmmakers. Exactly.
That occurs at Whole Foods.
There's no Sundance reel at Whole Foods this year.
How about that?
So,
there's
yes,
breaking
all
news
shows
for,
will be coming
me.
Here from
I will not
from
go KBCW. There.
Yep.
Stand around. Where asking where's
Waiting
my mic?
For a microphone to show up.
No, I will be in Florida doing some research there. On the environment for Sundance. And I'll report back. Let's thank again our guest, the first Dave Pacheco, Utah grassroots organizer with Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, talking about H.R. 4532. Go to the SUA website, suwa.org, to learn more about that House resolution.
And one of the important points he made is that they'll also be taking feedback very shortly. The federal government will be taking feedback for the management plans of both sort of the new Grand Staircase and the new Bears Ears. And so if you're interested in providing input, definitely hop on there.
The new tiny
Grand Staircase. National Monument.
Tiny National Monument. So that's a good way of putting it, unfortunately. So that thanked him and thank
And
our,
of course we want to thank Dr. James Staggy for joining us to talk about Utah's water future and how we can kind of look at the past through tree rings to learn about what's potentially coming our way in the future.
Seriously, bristlecone pines, and they're like, those are national monuments themselves. They need to be
really,
protected
yeah.
at all. And I think there is some states that have levels of protection mm-hmm. in place. But mm-hmm. they're amazing, amazing living things.
Yeah.
Hundreds of years old. So, all right, let's thank, of course, let's thank our underwriters, sponsors who make the show possible. They are Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and listeners like you.
Of course, you can email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
This is KPCW Radio, 91.7 FM, Park City. We've got your Wasatch back.
Say that slower.
Say it.
We have
Should I say it again?
Seconds. What do we have?
Three, two.
Here's NPR News.